Okay, let's get started. So last time we wrapped up the aftermath of the Avshalom David rebellion. And the main theme we had for last week was we saw two different approaches how to deal with the enemies of David's kingship, right? We had what we call the David model and the Yoav model. And the Yoav model, he really put forth extremely clearly when he yelled at David, he really yelled at David after David was mourning for Avshalom, right? When Yoav tells him, you're loving your enemies and you're hating your friends. And Yoav says, if you do that, you're going to end up with nobody. So Yoav's whole approach is very, very clear. I'm 100% on the side of my friends, and I am 100% opposed to my enemies. So for all of Yoav's insubordination and all of his decisions to take things into his own hands, throughout Sefer Shmuel, we never see a hint of disloyalty to David personally. Right? Yoav may think that he knows better than David what's good for David. You know, David may tell him, we're making peace with Avner, and Yoav may say, I think that's a bad idea. David may say, don't kill Avshalom. And Yoav may say, that's a bad idea. And in every case, we could debate whether David or Yoav is correct. But in terms of Yoav's allegiance, Yoav is totally loyal to David. And Yoav is completely opposed to any of David's enemies. And we see that Abishai, Yoav's younger brother, has exactly the same perspective. So both with Shaul back in Sefer Shmuel Aleph and with Shimi ben Gera here in Shmuel Beis, we see Abishai telling David, let's kill him. You know, Shaul's your enemy. Shimi ben Gera is your enemy. He's cursing you. He's throwing rocks at you. He's an enemy. We have to kill him. You hate your friends and you hate your enemies. You fight your enemies and you support your friends. And David consistently takes the other approach of trying to unify, trying to show mercy, and trying to bring people back into the fold. Are you a hardliner or are you, I guess, a softliner? And, you know, like anything in a complicated world, it's not like there's one uniformly correct approach across the board. And even in last week, we saw seemingly that the Navi endorsed Yoav in one place, endorsed David in another place, and a third place, we're not really sure. That's what we got to build up to this week. Right? When it came to Avshalom, it seems pretty clear that David was incorrect. Yoav was right. Avshalom was someone beyond redemption. And Avshalom needed to be killed in order to prevent future bloodshed. On the other hand, when it came to Shimi ben Gera, when David has mercy on Shimi, Navi seemed to support that decision as well. It seemed to endorse David's rachamim and disagree with Avishai's hardline position. And then the third person that David had surprising mercy on last week was his nephew, Amasa, who Avshalom had made the general to replace Yoav. Yoav, Avshalom, and Amasa are all first cousins. Normally, when you put down a rebellion, you would execute the general of the rebellious army. But instead of executing him, far from it, David is going to do something shocking, right? And he promotes him to be the general of the army. And the jury's going to be out, and we'll see that week whether that was a good move or a bad move. So that brings us into the end of Perek Yates, the beginning of Perek Chaf. In which we'll begin. I'm not sure what we'll finish. I was hoping we would, but now I'm kind of doubting it as I see how much we have to do. The Perek Chaf, which is the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri, which is kind of like the aftershock rebellion to the rebellion of Avshalom. Okay, we'll come back to the details of the map up here in a second. But as we get into the Pesukim, we should remember, we talked about this also last week, that as David comes back from having defeated Avshalom, and now the challenge is, can we put the monarchy back together? Let's remember, David has to deal with four different groups, right? We have Yehuda, which should be David's natural power base. But as we saw, Yehuda was angry with David because David seemed to not favor Yehuda above the other Shvatim. And therefore, Yehuda had actually joined Avshalom against David, right? Avshalom had originally been crowned as king in Hebron, which is the heart of the land of Yehuda. The second faction is in the land of Binyamin, up over here, the original Shaul HaMelech, faction. We see that they're still active even after all these years. The Navi told us that that Shimi ben Gera was from the family of Shaul. We saw that David had reason to suspect that Mephibosheth, the son of Yonasan, the grandson of Shaul, still harbored dreams of being king. We saw Chazal were as critical of David as he could be. He was completely wrong in that regard. But that's the second political group. We then have the rest of the tribes in the north, dominated by Ephraim, by Shevet Yosef. This is going to be the core of the kingdom of Yisrael after the split of the kingdom in Sefer Malachim up here. And then the fourth group is the Shvatim on the other side of the Jordan River over here. And this, surprisingly, had been David's core support during the rebellion of Avshalom. And he said the Shvatim here still were grateful to David for everything he did for them in fighting off all of Bnei Israel's enemies out into the east. And so David ran away from Yerushalayim. He ran to Mahanaim, which used to be the capital city of Ish-bosheth. Now they've totally turned sides and they are supporters of David. All right, so David attracts the supporters over here. They win the battle in the forest of Ephraim. And now David is coming back to Yerushalayim. And the challenge is, now can he rebuild? Right? Can he put things back together? And again, we have those three groups to think about: Yehuda, Binyamin, and the 10 tribes. Last week, we saw David's effort with Binyamin, because remember when Shimi ben Gera came back asking for forgiveness, Shimi didn't just come by himself saying, whoops, I'm sorry, it was a mistake to throw rocks at you and curse you out in public. Shimi came leading a delegation of 1,000 men of Shevet Binyamin. And Shimi's message was very clear: I have a political sway, and if you forgive me, I, a member of Shaul's family, have the ability to bring along a lot of Shevet Binyamin back onto your side. And David, with his accommodationless policy, accepts that. And so now, hopefully, Binyamin is back in the fold. But we saw, this is very quickly last week, we need to see it a little more in depth, that David does something which seems to be a big mistake. David takes his accommodationless policy, and David tries very hard to bring the people, the Shevet Yehuda, on board. How does he do so? He tells Yehuda, "Achayatem atzmi u'sariyatem." Right? He told them, "We're blood. We're flesh and blood." His whole kingship, David has tried to distance himself from this approach. He's not the king of one Shevet. He's the king of all of Bnei Israel. He's trying to command the loyalty of all the Shvatim, and so naturally, David has this tug of loyalties: is he the king for everybody, or is he the king for his Shevet? Well, now that David has lost the support of his Shevet, he needs to build it back up by, you know, having a more pro-Yehuda policy than he's had before. It's successful in the short term. Right? He reaches out to the Ziknei Yehuda, to the elders of Yehuda. He reaches out to Amasa, who's his nephew. It's successful. The Navi tells us, "Vayada, so you have called Ish Yehuda." He gets the people of Yehuda back on his side. But as we get to the end of Perek Yotes, and I have to be honest, I don't really... The split of the Perek between Perek Yotes and Perek Chaf is not really such a great division. The story really runs together. The last few psukim here give us the downside of that, right? Where the Navi tells us that Kol Ish Yisrael come to the king, and they say, "What's going on over here? How come Yehuda got first rights to bring you back on the other side of the Jordan River?" And Yehuda says, "Why are you upset? Echol achalum in hamelach and nises nisalanu." For how many years has David been king? And he's never given us anything. We've never had any special rights. We've never had any special privileges. So, you know, we were resentful of David. We wanted those special privileges. We never had them. So why are you upset that David finally gives us our moment in the sun, that he invites us to carry him back across the other side of the Jordan River? Ish Yisrael fights back. They say, "We have 10 portions in the king." Right, meaning there are 10 Shvatim against Shevet Yehuda, slash with maybe Shevet Shimon, because those are kind of together. And all of a sudden you have a fight. And we see how sensitive this is, right? Even the slightest whiff of favoritism that David shows all of a sudden blows up in his face. And what happens? We have somebody, Shevet Ben Bichri, who I'll talk about in depth in like just a minute, but just for now to understand how delicate this is politically. So one person, Shevet ben Bichri, gets up and he can say, "Ein lano chelik b'David, lo nachal lano ben Yishai, Yishalav Yisrael. We have no portion in David. We have no portion in the son of Yishai, right? Every man to his tent. And it works. All of a sudden, David loses Ish Yisrael. Yisrael leaves. Yehuda stays. We have here for the first time the split between Yehuda and the other Shvatim, which we know is really going to come into full force in Sefer Malach. Question is, though, we should ask, what exactly could David have done differently, right? It's easy to play Monday morning quarterback and say that by showing favoritism to Yehuda, David alienated the other 10 tribes. And that's clearly correct. Question is, what if David had done the opposite? What if he had not shown any favoritism to Yehuda? Would he have still not even gained the support of his own Shaven? It's not really clear that David had any viable political strategy over here. And what this does is this reinforces the argument that Chazal made last week that the punishment for David splitting the estate of Mephibosheth is that the kingdom is going to ultimately be torn from him. And we almost see the first instance of that this week. What could David have done? There's nothing that David could have done. I would say Hashem is the one who is directing the show over here. David is, it's all up to God whether this is going to succeed or not. No political strategy is going to give David victory. And Hashem doesn't help him out. It happens to be that the line that Sheva ben Bichri has over here is repeated virtually word for word by B'nai Yisrael in 40 plus years when the kingdom splits. Right? Shimi said over here, Ein lenu chelek b'David, lo nachla levanu ven Yishai. What do the people say when they split the kingdom in the time of Rechavam and Yeravam? Ma lenu chelek b'David, lo nachla ben Yishai. Lo lecha Yisrael. Go to your tents, Israel. Yishai love Yisrael. It's the exact same battle cry. So Chazal told us that the punishment for Mephibosheth was that the kingdom is going to be split. And we can argue that we already see immediately here the first hint of what is going to come. This is like, a shadow version of the split, which we're now walking into. And maybe there's nothing that David could have done. This is now set in stone. Right, but we certainly have clarity in terms of the massive political sensitivity that's over here. Right, you want to accommodate one side, well, the other side is going to get alienated. Okay, now as we turn to this person Sheva ben Bichri, right, the new rebel. We thought we were done with this. We thought we moved on from Avshalom. The Abarbanel has a critical insight, which I think is going to frame the entire Parak of the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri. Right? Let's first note what the Navi says about him. Before we even find out his name, the Navi wants to go out of its way. V'shem nikra ish bliyal, u'shmo Sheva ben Bichri ish yiminu. So he's from Binyamin. His name is Sheva ben Bichri. The first thing we're told, though, is that this is an ish bliyal. Again and again and again in Sefer Shmuel, from the very beginning, going back to when Chana told Eli, don't think that I am a Bas Belial. And then afterwards, we had Eli's sons, who the Navi told us were Bnei Belial. Belial is it's a charged term. It's a very, very loaded term in Sefer Shmuel. What does it mean? It means someone who is Belial, someone who is without a yoke, right? He acts totally, or she acts, I guess, in the alleged case of Chana, acts totally independently, without being subdued to somebody else, or without being subdued really to the Ribono Shel Olam. And the reason why that's such a charged term for the sons of Eli, we had it for Naval, we had it, I think, was it the assassins of Ish-bosheth? Maybe we've had it a couple of times before, and now we have it with Sheva ben Bichri, are people who the whole hashkafa of Sefer Shmuel, we said it so many times, we have to reiterate, goes back to Chana in the very, very beginning. Do we recognize that Hashem is all-powerful or not? Someone who is Belial, someone who is Belial, thinks of himself as all-powerful. He thinks of the authority only radiating from himself, and that is the term that the Navi slaps on Sheva ben Bichri before we even find out his name. So he gets up, right, and he blows the shofar, and he says he wants everyone to cast off that. Now the question is, what exactly did Sheva ben Bichri want? What did he want his rebellion to look like? Well, in comes the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel points out that Sheva ben Bichri never really tries to set himself up as king. Right? What does the Abarbanel say about Shavuot Bechri's vision? It says you have all the Shvatim. Yehuda is fighting if he gets David. The other Shvatim are fighting if they get David. So along comes Shevin, he says, who needs this whole monarchy in the first place? Ein anu tzrichin lemelach, kim leyos kol ish, sorer b'veso. Every person should be the master of his own house. So what does Sheva want? He is offering a vision of going back to Sefer Shoftim, right? Anarchy is the pitch that that Sheva ben Bechri is pitching to Bnei Yisrael. And we can set up, and we're going to see a number of times where the Navi kind of puts Avshalom and Sheva, these two rebellions, next to each other. Each rebellion is giving an alternative to David. Right? The whole Sefer Shmuel, we're trying to figure out what can be a viable government for Bnei Yisrael. And basically, we settled on Malchus Beis David as the least bad option. And the Navi did not shy away from the mistakes and the problems and the corruption that even a kingship led by David could produce. But now, what are the alternatives? Well, one alternative of Avshalom was the tyranny, right? The bloodthirsty king, the charismatic leader and ruler who's going to become, you know, like a cult of personality. And that ends up in tyranny, ends up with Avshalom, who wants to murder every single one of his opponents. Now I have like the radical opposite possibility, which is to go to no monarchy at all, to go back to anarchy, and going back to the era of the Shoftim. And as we'll see, especially when we get to the showdown of David's army against Sheva, the Navi is going to bring back the specter of Pilegesh Begiva and the whole civil war between Binyamin and the other Shvatim that ended Sefer Shoftim, which when we began learning Sefer Shmuel, we saw Chana is trying to help us, you know, and then Shmuel and then Shaul were trying to dig us out. So the pitch that that Sheva presents, it sounds very appealing. We've had all this discussion of the corruption of the king, going back to Sheva and then Uriah and then Avshalom and Amnon and Tamar. It's, you know, really ugly stuff. And we have a very appealing call from Sheva ben Bechri, who needs the whole thing? Ish la'olacha Yisrael. Every man go back to his tent. But what sounds very appealing, we already know from bitter history, is going to lead to disaster. Right? What he really wants is Belial, to have no yoke, and we know what that's going to lead to. Okay, so now, how is David going to respond? So, Pasuk Gimel is a pretty surprising pasuk. I have not really seen the very compelling explanation for what this is doing here. It's kind of surprising that Mepharshim don't really even address it. There's an open rebellion, so you'd think that immediately afterwards, David would begin fighting the rebellion. But kind of surprisingly, David does not do that. The first thing David does, the Navi tells us, he goes back to Yerushalayim, and he takes the 10 Pileg Shim, who had been raped by Avshalom, and he puts them in the Beis Mishmeres, right? He puts them in the guarded, protected house, where they're going to be fed and supported. However, David is not going to be with any of these Pileg Shim anymore. Right? The idea is if somebody has slept with the wife of the king, so David feels that it is no longer appropriate, it's a degradation to the institution of monarchy, he cannot be with these women anymore. Chazal discuss whether or not this was halachically mandated or if it wasn't. But it seems clear that David's priority here is to emphasize the importance of the institution of monarchy, right? Right, we have here what becomes the famous line, they become like living widows. Right? They're married to the king. They cannot be with anyone else. You know, this comes up in halacha in the context of yibum and chalitza. A king does not do yibum, a king does not do chalitza. There are certain cases where the kavod, which is required for a king, and the halacha, unlike a parent, right? If someone's a parent and he wants to forego his honor, that's permissible. But when it comes to a king is not. This is the problem David had with Avshalom. When you're the king, you're not just the person. You represent the institution of kingship, and that has to be held to a higher level. And therefore, even though David, the person, would love to just reunite with the Pilag Shim, David, the king, is not able to do so. And it seems, I think, that the reason why this pasuk is right here is that David is correct. David is sensing part of the rebellion of Sheva ben Bechri, is grounded in this desire to return to anarchy. And the first thing David has to do is David has to emphasize that there is indeed a certain elevation to the concept of the Melech. Right? This has been eroded by Amnon, it's been eroded by Absalom, now it's been eroded by Sheva. And the first thing David does is he goes back to Yerushalayim, he goes back to the capital city, he goes back to the palace, and he has to make a declaration. It's not about me, it's about the Melech, it's about the Malchus, and therefore the 10 Pilekshim have to go into the Beis HaMishmeres. So now he's made the political statement. David can get the army together, and now he's going to try to actually fight Sheva ben Bichri. So what does he do? So he goes to Amasa, who 5 minutes ago had been fighting against him as Avshalom's general, but now he's David's general. And he tells David, "I gather up the men of Yehuda." Because again, we see, right? David knows his new power base is Yehuda. He's not trying to get the other Shvatim. They've abandoned him, but he tries to get the men of Yehuda. It's not crazy to have Amasa do it. Amasa, possibly. Right? Amasa is clearly somebody who the men of Yehuda are loyal to, but it doesn't work out. It doesn't work out, clearly. Amasa goes to call out Yehuda, but they don't show up. 3 days go by, and he's not there. So then David goes to Avishai. And he turns to Avishai, the brother of Yoav, and he says, this is bad, right? This could get even worse than Absalom's rebellion. Take the servants of your master. Right? Lest Sheva get into some fortified cities and he'll escape. So what happens? The men of Yoav go after. In other words, we don't have a general mobilization of Yehuda, which is what Amasa was supposed to do. Instead, we get like the standing professional army, the Anshei Yoav, the Krasi and the Plasi. That was the palace guard. Those are the people who have been with David through thick and thin. So, you know, like the on-call army, and they leave Yerushalayim. We need to figure out is, you know, why is David turning to Amasa? And then what exactly is happening here with Avishai and Yoav? And the Radak opens up what's going to be a theme in the whole parak. And it's really been a theme in the Sefer as well. Whenever anybody, especially people of a more impressive stature, make mistakes, right? We had this with Shaul many times. We've had this with David. We've had this with Yoav especially. So often when people make mistakes, it is because they convince themselves that what they're doing for their own personal reasons, they're really doing for other reasons, right? Says the Radak, why did David turn to Amasa? The best general in the history of Bnei Yisrael is Yoav ben Tzruya. You know, I don't know how old Yoav ben Tzruya was when he conquered Yerushalayim, but he was no older than somebody in his like early 20s probably. You know, he's been a military master from the beginning of his career until now. Says the Radak, Lo Amar Le Yoav Ki Blibo Hayal LaHasiro. He wanted to fire Yoav. Shol Yatzar Tzba'o Mipnei Sheharag Avshalom. It's the pshat. David is furious with Yoav because Yoav killed his son. Now, Yoav was correct, but David is putting a personal desire above the best policy. Now, we can imagine there are rationalizations that David could give for what he's doing over here. I forget who, I'm not sure if it's the Abarbanel. One of the Mepharshim says, maybe they're all bag, that David is concerned because Yoav has shown that he's not, he could be disobedient. You know, it's not that David is necessarily personally troubled by Yoav killing Avshalom. It's that he's politically concerned. If he could ignore my order to kill Avshalom, who knows what other order he's going to ignore? I want to have a general who's going to be more obedient to me. Now, you could stop and think for a second. Oh, you want a general who's more obedient to you? So you're going to hire the guy who betrayed you, your nephew who betrayed you and became the general of the other army? Does that really make so much sense? Oh. Right. The other political argument would be, I need Yehuda on my side, and so I'm going to go with the man who Yehuda is very loyal to. People from Yehuda have been very close to Amasa, so you can make the political argument. But the Radak is saying that really why David is doing this is for personal reasons. And that should tell us that this is a mistake. And it seems like a mistake because Amasa is not doing the job. We'll have to ask why he's not doing the job. We'll get there in a couple of minutes. Right. The other piece here, which is interesting, is that the Navi tells us that David said to Avishai, "Kach es avdei Adonecha." Well, who are the servants of your master. Who's the master being discussed over here? So the Mefarshim debate whether it's David, whether it's Yoav. It seems like it should be Yoav, because who follows Avishai? Anshe Yoav. So is Yoav the master of Avishai? So Abarbanel disagrees. Abarbanel says no. Abarbanel says the Mefarshim say that it's Yoav. I don't think so. Abarbanel says, and Yachshov, Shlokra Adono Kim Hamelach Atzmo. When you have the master, right? The master is David. Remember, this is how Chazal sensed the insubordination from Uriah Hachiti. When Uriah looked David in the eye and said, Adoni Yoav, right? My master Yoav is out in the field. And Chazal said, you know, only time in Tanakh we ever see somebody talking to the king and calling someone else their Adon. So Abarbanel has a good argument here that David means me. At the same time, we can't even sense that the Navi is kind of winking to us, you know, that David may think that they're Avdei Adonacha, that they're the Avadim of David. But in reality, who do these people serve? Who do these people have their primary loyalty to? These are Anshei Yoav. And we see the limitation of the power of the king. He tried to fire Yoav by going to Amasa. That didn't work because Amasa was not up to the job. Then he tries to fire Yoav by at least turning to Yoav's brother Avishai. At the end of the day, though, these are Anshei Yoav. And Yoav does not miss the opportunity to take command again. The people, he has loyalty to the people of the soldiers, and he's not going to meet any resistance when he tries to take command. So the army is going north. So they're at the large stone, which is in Gibbon. I forget, I think it's the Dadmikra. Somebody suggests that this large stone is the Mizbeach, because the Mishkan is still active in Gibbon right now. And then all of a sudden, Amasa shows up in front of them. And now Yoav apparently is also here. Apparently Yoav came along for the ride. He wasn't invited, but he wasn't missing this opportunity. He's there with his special war apparel. The Malbim even suggests that Yoav is wearing his special general's uniform. You know, there's a special uniform for the general of the army. So you can imagine the message that Yoav is sending by wearing that. And he has this sword, which is, he strategically places in a way that it's going to be able to fall down. Right? And then Yoav goes up to Amasa, and Yoav tricks him, and he says, Hashalom ata achi, right? Is everything good? My brother, remember their first cousins. Then he grabs Amasa's beard with his right hand, and then he bends over, his sword falls out. Yoav, who's exceptionally skilled militarily, picks up the sword with the left hand, hits Amasa and kills him instantly. So we need to ask, why did Yoav do this? Why did Yoav kill Amasa? Now the easy answer and the correct answer, the Mefarshim all say, is that Yoav kills Amasa for the personal reason that Yoav wants to be the general. He wants to get Amasa out of his way. And it's the exact same personal desire that we saw with David firing Amasa, we have here with Yoav assassinating Amasa. Once again, though, it is more complicated than that. There are reasons and justifications that Yoav could put forward why he's doing what he is doing. Yoav and Avishai meet Amasa in Gibeon, right? Where is Gibeon? Let's go back up to the map at the top of the source sheet for a second. I think it should be there. Right. Here's Gibeon. Problem is, why Gibeon is in the heart of the land of Binyamin. Amasa is not supposed to be in the land of Binyamin. Amasa is supposed to be rallying all of the soldiers from Yehuda. And then David gave him 3 days to get the men of Yehuda to Yerushalayim. 3 days go by, Amasa is missing in action. So David says, okay, forget about Yehuda. Avishai, just take the in-house troops and go after Sheva immediately. And then while they march north, imagining that Amasa is somewhere down here, all of a sudden they find Amasa in the land of Binyamin at Gibeon. This doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense for him to be there. So there are two explanations of why this has happened. The Rav Amnon Bazak and the VBM. So he suggests that actually Amasa had betrayed David. Amasa betrayed David once when he went onto the side of Avshalom. He suggests that Amasa has betrayed David again, and that is why he is in the land of Binyamin. Let's remember who is from Binyamin in this whole story, Sheva ben Bichri. He suggests that Amasa is trying to sabotage the effort, and that's why he is in the land of Sheva's Shaven, rather than gathering the army together. Very interesting suggestion. The problem with it is that it seems almost undeniable that the Navi is critical of Yoav for doing this. That Amasa was not a traitor over here. We're going to see, I think it's going to be pretty clear as we go through the story, the next few psukim, that the Navi is critical of Yoav for this. So the other possibility, I was hoping someone would say this, and I was happy I found in a footnote that Dot Mikra did make this suggestion, and we need to unpack it though. And maybe Amasa was there in Binyamin because Amasa is putting himself in a diplomatic mission. Rather than gather the army of Yehuda together to fight against Sheva ben Bichri, Amasa decides to try to cut the rebellion off at its root by going to the land of Binyamin and undermining the political support for Sheva ben Bichri. Go to Sheva's own Shevet and get his own people to refuse to support him. Right. They suggest that's what Sheva was actually doing. The fantastic irony of this, it's really like unbelievable, is that Amasa and Yoav end up as like total parallel opposites to each other. David had commanded Yoav to have mercy on Avshalom, and Yoav decided by himself, I think that's a bad tactic. We should kill Avshalom. David commands Amasa, go fight, get the army together to fight against Sheva ben Bichri. And Amasa seems to decide, I think that's too harsh an approach. Let's go with the mercy approach and try to negotiate with the people of Binyamin and see if we can end this war without a fight. So we would have both Amasa and Yoav, right, disobeying David's command, in each case because they each think that what they're doing is for the best of the country. Yoav thinking we need to fight for the best of the country. Amasa thinking we need to have negotiation for the peace of the country. Right, so they're both disobeying David, but for opposite reasons. However, if that's the case, then what does Yoav do? Yoav jumps to conclusions. We can suggest that what Yoav does, Yoav sees Amasa and Givon, and rather than saying, he was on a DIY peace mission. Yoav reads Amasa like Rav Bazak, and the VBM reads Amasa. He says, look at this. He's a traitor. Instead of being in, he's AWOL, and instead of being in Yehuda getting the army, he's together with Binyamin. And that provides him with the justification to murder Amasa, right? Yoav still can't believe that David let Amasa off the hook the first time. My cousin betrayed us to be the general of Avshalom's forces. Now he's doing it again. So Yoav jumps to conclusions and goes to assassinate Amasa. Now, we can't deny, though, that what is helping push Yoav in that direction, what is helping Yoav to jump to conclusions that Amasa is a traitor who should be killed, it is that personal desire that he wants to be the general. Right. So it's the same exact story as David, just in side. David wanted to fire Yoav for personal reasons, and he had the political justification for it. And Yoav wants to kill Amasa for personal reasons, but he also has the political justification for it. And for Yoav, this is the third time we've seen this already, right? Yoav's done this exact same thing three times. He did this with Avner, where he killed Avner. The Navi told us it was a Gol Hadam, right? He was redeeming the blood of his brother Asael. Of course, conveniently, Yoav was also protecting his position as general, because otherwise Avner might have taken over the job. We had that with Avshalom, where Yoav had personal animus towards Avshalom, because Avshalom burned his whole field. But there's also the political reason, which is that he feels that this is for the good of the country. And now we have this again with Amasa, right? Three different times, every time Yoav has killed someone, it's in a gray zone. There's a personal reason for it, and then there's a more legitimate reason for it. In the case of Avshalom, the Navi seemed to support David. In the case of Avner, it was hard to tell. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Yoav was able to get off for the killing. The Navi itself said that Yoav did indeed do this for Gaal Hadam. Now we have the case of Amasa, and this is the one which seems the most, where we seem the most opposed to Yoav's conduct. Go back to the Pesukim for a sec. Let's just take a minute to understand what exactly Yoav does, and the Navi is going to describe this, right? So the Navi tells us Amasa didn't anticipate the sword, so Yoav kills him, right? And then the Navi tells us Vayishpuch me'av arza v'lo shana lo vayamos. So the Navi is going to be exceptionally graphic. The key hint to us that the Navi is going to be opposed to what Yoav did is the Navi is going to really show us in graphic terms what happened, right? First, the Navi tells us that he disemboweled Amasa. And it's very impressive to do that with the left hand. You know, Yoav knows exactly what he's doing. When Yoav killed Avshalom, he hit him in a way that he was very, very careful, that he could stab him three times, but Avshalom wasn't going to die. And this time, it's like the opposite. Yoav is able, you know, in 1 second with his left hand, while also hugging and kissing Amasa, to kill him instantly. The Navi says he's disemboweled. Why is it so important for us to know? Well, as the Pesukim are going to continue, we're going to see that people are going to freak out when they see the graphic image of a disemboweled Amasa on the side of the road. Chazal explained what this means. We should just know what it is. Right? He hit him at the fifth rib. This is the fourth time we've seen the fifth rib mentioned in Sefer Shmuel. Avner killed Asael by stabbing him in the fifth rib. Then Yoav killed Avner, Mida Keneged Mida, by stabbing him in the fifth rib. The assassins of Ishbosheth stabbed him in the fifth rib. And now we have the fifth rib for the last time. So we would think of the fifth rib as like, you know, counting down this way, you know, and counting, and it would be like around the area of the heart. That's not what the Gemara says, though. We just know what this is. The Gemara says that this is the place where the liver and the gallbladder are suspended from. What does that mean? So just, you know, take a picture over here, right? So it's normally, in like modern anatomy, we count the ribs down this way. We say 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And the fifth rib would be up over here. Right? That's where like the heart would be. You see the liver and the gallbladder are down here. So that's clearly not the fifth rib. But when the Navi talks about the chomesh, they don't mean the ribs in this way. They mean the ribs as they come out of the sternum, right? So you could see here, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So what Yoav is doing is he's stabbing Amasa right underneath the bottom rib, right in the gut. And that is how he is hitting right into the liver and the gallbladder, and all of Amasa's internal organs come flying out. So Amasa's killed instantly, and it's a really ugly picture. That's exactly what Yoav is doing. We should just be able to envision it, because that's going to be important in the next couple of seconds. Now, how do we know the Navi is supposed to this? Well, first of all, when Yoav is going to be executed by Shlomo, so David is going to reiterate that this was the wrong thing to do. He's going to reiterate that that Yoav never should have killed Amasa. This is wrong. But then, as the Pesukim continue, we'll just look at this. We'll look at the actual rebellion, the end of the Shimei rebellion next week in Rinzai Shem. Now, let's just conclude with putting the assassination of Amasa behind us. Then he tells us, "V'ish amar alav me'nare Yoav." You know what? Scope for 1 second. Sorry, Nevi told us clear on this point. After killing Amasa, what happens? Yoav Abishai Achiv Radaf Acharei Shevi Bin Bichri. So Yoav doesn't look back. He kills Amasa, and then he and his brother Abishai, who always follows after him, they're moving on, right? And the expectation should be that the army moves on as well after them. But that is not what happens. Be'ish amar alav minarei Yoav ayomer mi asher chavetz b'Yoav u'mi asher l'David acharei Yoav. Anybody who wants to follow Yoav, let's go. Why does this random soldier, this random one of Yoav's na'arim, have to get up and say that? Because it's clear that the army does not want to continue. They're horrified by what Yoav did to Amasa. And these are Avde Yoav. These are Yoav's men. This is the Crazy and the Placey. This is the hardcore loyalists. They are horrified by what just happened. So it seems clear that the Navi thinks that to the outside observer, this was totally out of bounds. And then look what the Navi says. V'amasa misgolel badam besocha mesila. Amasa is right, he's wallowing in his blood in the middle of the street. You can see the whole army is watching and they're just staring at Amasa, who has been disemboweled by Yoav. Avishai and Yoav are running down the road. They're saying, let's go, let's go. And no one is following them. Vayar ha'ish ki amad kol ha'am. This is a disaster. He sees that the army will not move. So what does this ish have to do? So he has to pick up Amasa and take him off to the side of the road and cover him up with the garment, because this is like the greatest rubbernecking traffic jam in history. No one wants to move. Everyone's horrified. And then once the people don't see Amasa anymore, then all of a sudden they're able to go. But the Navi here is very clearly showing that what Yoav did was incorrect. And it's being contrasted, with this we'll close, it's being contrasted with two other pieces that we've already seen in Shmuel Beis. One from the rebellion of Absalom, and one from way, way back, the very first time we saw the Chomesh treatment happen. We'll look at that first. Let's remember in Perek Beis, right? When Avner, there was that needless civil war between Avner's forces and Yoav's forces. And so Avner turns around and he tries to get Asael, the younger brother of Yoav and Abishai, to turn aside. Asael doesn't turn aside, so Yoav turns. Avner turned around, took the butt of his spear, and killed Asael. What happened? So the Navi said, "Vayehi kol abal makom asher nafal sham Asael vayamos vayamodu." So as Yoav's men are chasing after Avner, the same thing happens. They find a disemboweled Asael, who looks just the same, it's just as graphic as what happened to Amasa, and they're horrified, right? They stand on the spot, they stop fighting because they are horrified by what happened. But what happened then? They yedufu Yoav Abishai acharei Avner. But Yoav and Abishai, once again, the brothers, it's their own brother who was killed, but they are so locked into the fighting, that doesn't stop them. They continue the chase. And at that point, it was clear that they were successful in getting the army to continue on their way. So that last time, Yoav and Abishai were able to inspire their own men to, you know, get past this and keep going. This time, though, when Yoav is the one who did the killing, he fails. He keeps running, but his soldiers stay behind. So if Yoav thought he needed to do this because I need to be the leader, I need to be the general, it totally backfires, right? And then the other contrast we have here is with the rebellion of Absalom. The last time we saw Yoav killing somebody, everything was in the exact inverse. Remember, it was that random ish. There was some anonymous member of the army came to Yoav and he said, "I found Absalom and he's hanging up in a tree, caught by his hair." And Yoav said, you fool, why didn't you kill him? And the guy said, "I'm not going to kill him. I think I'm going to risk my life alienating David. You wouldn't stand by me." And Yoav told him, "Lo kein, you got me wrong. I'm a man of my word. And I meant what I said. Tell me where Avshalom is." And immediately Yoav takes action and he goes and he kills Avshalom personally. And that was the correct decision. It ended the war. Right? Here we have the exact opposite. We have the anonymous ish and we have Yoav the general. Except here, rather than it being the anonymous person who is prolonging the battle, and Yoav, who by taking action is able to end the war, that was a correct decision to kill Absalom. Right, here it's the opposite. Yoav kills Amasa, and now all of a sudden his army won't fight. Right, it's the murder, it's the killing, which has messed up the army. And rather than Yoav cleaning up the mistake of the anonymous man, we need the anonymous ish to literally clean up the mistake of Yoav, right? We need him to fill in the gap, fill in the breach, in order to allow the people to keep going. So it's clear that the Navi thinks that what Yoav did was wrong over here, right? And it's the same story for David we have for Yoav. We have the personal rationalization, and then we have at the end of the day, there's the official rationalization, but then at the end of the day, the fact that they're doing this for personal means clouds their judgment and leads to a real failure in leadership. So we'll close here. We'll see next week, the actual end of the rebellion. And we'll see Yoav redeem himself, really in pretty striking fashion, I think. I think it's actually pretty inspiring what Yoav's going to do next week, but we'll hold off on this for now. So,
bye. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Awesome.
Thanks for coming. And have a great rest of the week. Nesiyah tova, and looking forward.
Mazel tov. Hope you make your flight.
Thanks so much. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Bye.